Good afternoon, and welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. In the United States, the most common cancer in women is breast cancer. The good news is that the incidence seems to be possibly beginning to decrease. The bad news? Well, the incidence seems a little higher in Alaska than many other states. Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Outside Anchorage, toll-free 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll be talking about breast cancer on Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with the wheelchair on the sign.
Welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is breast cancer, the most common cancer in women in the United States. Before I introduce my guests and remind you of our phone numbers again, I want to make a brief comment about something that's also equally important, and that's influenza. You've heard enough about that maybe, but I still get lots of questions of concern. My own personal vendetta about the word flu, we need to talk about. Flu is often used to mean various and sundry viruses, and often people mean vomiting and diarrhea. True influenza is not a gastrointestinal illness for the most part. It's a respiratory illness. Lots of cough, lots of headache, lots of fever. 3 to 5 days is not unusual. You will know you've been sick if you have influenza. This year, there are two big categories of influenza, the seasonal influenza, which is comes around every year, usually peaks in March, and the H1N1, or what has been called swine flu, which has been present all summer and is already beginning to increase in incidence as kids have gotten back to school. The vaccine for the seasonal flu is available. That's what the pharmacies are having. That's what many physicians have. Anywhere you get that vaccine, it'll be effective for seasonal flu. It takes a lot of time to develop these influenza vaccines, about 9 months, and because of the fact that H1N1 flu was really only discovered earlier in the year. It's going to be about October before we get the first doses of that vaccine, and you'll need both to be fully protected. The other thing I'd like to remind people about, influenza is a deadly illness. About 37,000 people each year will have, there'll be an excessive death of about 37,000 each year due to influenza-related illness. That's about the same, only slightly lower than the number of people that are killed in automobile accidents each year in this country. So it's a significant illness. The other thing maybe worth talking about is you're most contagious, or certainly very contagious, the day before you are sick. You know you're sick, so the only way you can keep people from being transmitted safely from other individuals is to get the vaccine, so you have a reasonable assurance that you will not be sick or get sick. If you have this infection percolating, you're going to transmit it before you even know you have it, and so it's not very effective in saying I'm going to just keep my friends from getting it by knowing when I'm sick I'll stay away from them. Unfortunately, it won't work that way. Our phone numbers, again, for those who are familiar with us, you can listen, and you listen to APRN Talk of Alaska, and it's the same numbers in Anchorage, 550-8422. Our toll-free number, again, 1-800-478-8255, and our email is line1, you spell it all the way out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at aprn.org. My guests today are Dr. Denise Farley. She's director of the Providence Imaging Center and director of mammography there. She's been with us a number of times. We've kind of made this a yearly sojourn to talk about where we're going with breast cancer. And joining us today in the studio is also Dr. Tina Thompson, a gynecologist with Alaska Women's Clinic. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Well, I like to start with the basics. Who's going to tell me what cancer is, and then we'll start focusing in on breast cancer. What's different about cancer?
Oh, I think the easy way to explain it is that cancer is just a bunch of cells that don't respect their neighbors. You know, they start elbowing other people out of the way and pretty soon take over the neighborhood, which is pretty counterproductive.
So most cells in the human body have some kind of programming genetic thing that tells them when to die, when to keep moving along, not to make too many of themselves.
Correct.
Cancer doesn't do that.
They know how to sit in their seats when they're on the bus.
What?
They're polite. Oh, they respect their neighbors. Yeah. They sit down.
Normal cells do.
Normal cells.
I see. Yeah. And cancer cells have lost that neighborly. I'm going to crowd you out. I'm going to take over whatever I need to take over. I want your food. I want your blood vessels and so forth.
They're bullies to the point that they can kill the whole neighborhood.
And so, tremendous amount of research over a number of years has been trying to understand why that happens. And it may not be the same reason in all cancers. We have this idea that cancer is a cancer, but that may be that that's not true. In fact, it's probably not true. They're all kind of different illnesses, and they may have different problems, different triggers, different risk factors.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the basic things about our immune system is we have cells that cruise around, I don't know, like our police department or something, looking for the wayward cells and getting rid of them. And in many cases, when we develop a cancer, it's because of a deficiency in that immune system, a defect.
Mm-hmm. What are common symptoms? Women, I hope nowadays, know that they need to have some screening, and we can come back to that question. But what is it that a woman may find on exam or have a symptom that might suggest that they need to get that checked further?
The scariest symptom that women will sometimes present with that really alarms them right away is a bloody discharge from the nipple. Although that often proves to be a papilloma, it may not be a cancer. In fact, it may have some chance of being a cancer, but the majority are just simple papillomas, growths inside the ducts.
And so a papilloma is a fancy word for, yeah, it's something new, but it's more controlled. It's not it's not crowding out its neighbor. It knows where to sit stay in its seat on the bus, right?
Correct.
But it may cause some bleeding, and that would be alarming to anybody.
It's rowdy, but
tameable.
It's not taken over.
Okay. All right. And any other symptoms that we need to think about? I always remember hearing about dimpling of the skin in women, and obviously feeling a nodule may lead to it. But lots of nodules also don't come to mean anything significant.
Lumps are probably the most common, and yet of lumps, the majority are not cancers. Skin dimpling, changing of the skin on the surface, and retraction of the nipple, one side rather than both, and a change from previous. There are some women who have a nipple retraction standardly, but a change is very important.
And one other thing, just to get this business about definitions and so forth, there's different kinds of breast cancer. So what are we talking about primarily, and then maybe throw in a few other ones that names and terms related to breast cancers. So there's carcinoma in situ, and then you guys tell me.
There's a number of cancers. Okay. Invasive ductal carcinoma is actually the most common, and it can have various behaviors. Some invasive ductal carcinomas are very aggressive, and others are pretty indolent. But it's at least 60% to 70% of the breast cancers. And carcinoma in situ is another one. That's an early cancer.
Ductal carcinoma means to me it's part of the duct system, and those cells have lost control.
That's exactly right.
Right. Okay.
And
in situ means then?
In situ means a cancer that's better behaved. It's still inside the duct. It's not yet grown outside the duct. In theory, it has no opportunity then to spread elsewhere in the body. So it's an early diagnosis of cancer if we find an in situ lesion.
Would you say then that carcinoma in situ is a juvenile delinquent rather than a
exactly
doesn't need to go
exactly
to-
other kinds of invasive cancers? There's invasive lobular cancer. That's only about 10% of the cancers that we see. It's also very difficult to diagnose. It often is fairly well behaved. It's a slower growing tumor in general, but it can get very large because it's hard to find on physical exam. It's also hard to see on a mammogram. And then there's a whole ton of little smaller number of cancers like papillary carcinoma and mucinous carcinoma. There are multiple cell types, and they all have different kinds of behavior.
So when we talk about risk or who should be screened, we are primarily talking about the common cancers. And these other cancers can kind of show up outside of the recommended screening age group and individuals. So I'm saying if we have one of these unusual cancers, would they more likely happen in or is equally likely to happen in a younger woman as an older woman? Or does the screening recommendation really is there for all of these different cancers?
It's there for all of them.
Okay.
It's there for all of them.
So age is a factor in all of the cancers.
Age is a huge factor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Other than being female, it's the most important risk factor for breast cancer. So as women age, as they go through their lives, the incidence of breast cancer continues to go up regardless of how old we get. So it's very low in women in their 20s. It goes up a little bit in their 30s. It continues to rise and even rises, you know, up until they're in their 90s.
And so who should be screened and when should they be screened and how should they be screened?
That's actually a cultural question. you know, one of the articles you sent us, Thad, talked about screening in different countries and some of the data that they came up with. And it's been very interesting to me that in different countries, screening recommendations vary. In the United States, we generally recommend that women between 50 and 75 get mammograms yearly. Recommendations between 40 and 50 vary a little bit. I know the American Academy of Radiology recommends yearly screening for women between 40 and 50, but that's not a universal recommendation. Different groups recommend different things. I'm not aware that any other countries at all recommend screening before 50. It's kind of an interesting topic in and of itself. And then the question is, when do you stop screening? And then we go into specific high-risk groups. If that you have a family history of young breast cancer, then they recommend starting screening earlier. And if you yourself are a genetic carrier, then screening, even screening with MRIs these days. There are kind of subgroups of screening recommendations.
There are. It's interesting, though, that there's been some work done about the question about do you start at age 40 or do you start at age 50. The reason the American College of Radiology recommends starting at age 40 is because there's really good data that if we effectively screen those women, we are picking up cancers that sometimes are more aggressive. And so there's a strong argument to be made for that. But you're right. And what do you do with the exceptionally high-risk patient? Do you do a different kind of screening? Do you start screening earlier? And I think each one of those has to be individualized because it's a small number of people, and our recommendations are going to be tailored to that person and her set of circumstances. Mammography is our standard screening tool, and it remains the standard tool. And I think we haven't found anything, actually, that does better for population-based screening than mammography. But we do have other tools as well, and currently the one that people are talking the most about is breast MRI. And it can be very effective, but it's only been proven to be effective in very high-risk populations. It's not the kind of thing that we're going to say to a woman who is of average risk that she should be screened with breast MRI as well as mammography. On the other hand, if she's got a breast cancer mutation or if there's a breast cancer mutation in her family, then we might well make that recommendation to her.
Isn't it true, Denise, that with breast MRI screening, for instance, in BRCA carriers, that they can show that you're finding the cancers earlier, but we haven't yet seen the data on mortality rates?
That's correct, because that work is still in progress. They started doing that sort of screening in Europe a little earlier than we did here in the United States, but you're absolutely right. We do not know whether it's going to impact long-term survival or mortality.
Let's back up a second. BRCA is?
Well, there's BRCA 1 and 2, and those are genetic mutations that can be carried on a couple of different genes. They tend to be familial. There are a couple of groups genetically that seem to carry them with greater frequency. And what they are is genetic defects in some of those cruiser immune system cells that help get rid of early mm-hmm. cancer. So women who, for instance, if you're in a family with a lot of breast or breast and ovarian cancers, you can get tested for some of the mutations that we have found among the BRCA1 and 2 genes. And if you're a carrier of one of those, then you're in a high-risk group and your lifetime risk of developing breast or breast and ovarian cancer are higher.
And I think in the past, and my recollection is that is a small percentage of the women with breast cancer. I mean, people keep thinking about the genetics, but in fact, we're not able at this point to identify genetically increased risk in the vast majority of women who have breast cancer.
Absolutely.
That's true. So cervical and ovarian and breast cancer can track together, and high incidence in a family should raise the suspicion of having that genetic predisposition, which could be important and also brings us ethical issues. I think maybe last time you were here, Denise, we talked about women who have found that and how do they talk to their children, their female daughters, and so forth. So that's another issue. But the one you bring up is, so now we got this and we know, should we be testing those people earlier if we are screening them early? And if we are screening them early, does it have an impact in outcome? Right.
Correct.
Let me remind our listeners once again, if you have questions today about what you're hearing, our local number is 550-8422, 550-8422. Toll-free number 1-800-478-8255, and you can call or email us at line 1 at line 1 at APRN.org. And remember also, if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a tape rebroadcast, and we won't be able to address your questions. I'm going to go ahead and take an email that was sent to me prior to the program I think is worth talking about at this point. I'd like to share my story, the writer says, even though I'm very close to the beginning. I've lived in Alaska, and I've had very good health insurance, which has allowed me to have yearly mammograms at little or no cost. This year I was thinking, they've never found anything, and it's such an uncomfortable procedure, maybe I'll skip it this year. But I didn't, because I thought of a woman I worked with who didn't take the time for a few years, and when they found her cancer, it was too late, and she died. I had a mammogram, and they discovered calcification in my left breast. I was called back to have a magnified mammogram. Very soon afterwards, I had a biopsy and diagnosed my condition as ductal carcinoma in situ. Last week, I had a partial mastectomy, and the lab report confirmed that the doctor had removed all of the tumor, I guess. That's a word here I'm not familiar with. I am waiting for the appointment with an oncologist and will probably start radiation soon. I feel very fortunate and glad that I've learned from my friend's mistake. I'm also fortunate that doctors who've been helping me have been very quick and efficient in my treatment. To me, there's a number of issues there. You guys want to comment on this?
I think she's absolutely right. If screening is to work, it has to be performed consistently. It's not enough to have a mammogram and then wait 10 years and decide to have another one. Whether you start at age 40 or start at age 50, and whether you have your mammogram every year, which is what the American College of Radiology recommends, or whether you choose to be screened at a little longer interval, you do need to have screening performed on a regular basis. We are trying to find very subtle abnormalities, and we're trying to find very subtle changes. So we're looking to find things early, and it will make a difference.
One of the things I like to mention to people about screening is that there's the common misperception that we ought to, or perhaps we do have a screening test for every cancer that can happen in the body. And the truth is, we've only got a few good ones. The best screening methods we have are for diseases that grow slowly, where over the course of years, we have a bunch of opportunities to find them early. So if there's a disease that grows very quickly, and for instance, screening is done once a year, and it takes only a month to grow to a malignant stage, then we don't have good screening tests. And that's really why we have so few. You know, as a gynecologist, of course, I'm the proud owner of rights to the pap smear. And you know, the world's never seen a better screening test than the pap smear. We're not perfect, but we have, well used. The pap smear can reduce cervical cancer deaths by about 97%. With mammograms, we're doing better and better all the time. But I think we're up to, about 70%, I think. Isn't that right? 70 to 80, maybe?
Probably more like 80. I think, obviously it depends on what age of patients you're talking about. If you have a population that's a lot of high-risk patients and people with very dense breast tissue, we don't do so well. But no, we cannot see all breast cancers with mammography. Absolutely not.
And when it comes to developing a screening test, it's a little bit like going around through the neighborhood and knocking on people's doors and saying, excuse me, have you considered worrying about breast cancer lately? Have you considered worrying about this lately? And before we start alarming the population, we ought to have something that'll make a difference in disease and death rates. And that's really only a few diseases, really, that we've gotten that far with.
And another couple things about screening tests that we've talked about on the program before is you really don't want to miss something on a screen test. You don't want a false negative. And as a result, you're going to have false positives, which we're more likely to be willing to accept. And all screening tests often have an increased instance of false positives.
That's true. And I think you're right. You do have to accept a certain number of those to avoid that false negative.
Right.
And the false negative means that there's a cancer there that we don't perceive, we don't find. And so we may overstep a little bit and call some things that turn out to be benign. But for the most part, we're willing to do that.
And just to be sure everybody understands, you could do everything right with mammography and still develop a cancer after your yearly screening that was so invasive, or to use Dr. Thompson's analogy, such a bad guy, didn't want to pay attention to the rules, that very, very quickly that tumor is so malignant that it could be too late by the time you saw somebody.
That's right, and that's why it's so important not to ignore a new symptom. Even if you have your mammogram today, mm-hmm. if 2 months from now you develop a lump in your breast that's new, you really do need to march in and see your clinician and get that evaluated, because that lump could be very important even though it wasn't seen on your mammogram.
Or, you know, like Denise was saying earlier, tissue type, because the lobular ones are harder to find. And I think a crude statistic that I sometimes give patients is that about of lumps, for instance, even if we have a lump and we send them down to you to investigate, there are some of those lumps that you can't see on a mammogram or cone mag views or anything, and we still may need to investigate with a biopsy, for example.
That's right. We do better with that than we used to, because we have ultrasound as a secondary tool. And typically the patient that comes in with a lump that I can't see on the mammogram is going to get an ultrasound, because we're going to want a different kind of a look at it.
And I know that of you, so I just order it.
That's right.
Just a reminder, our local phone number, if you've got questions about breast cancer, 550-8422. Toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And you can email us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at APRN.org. And you need to do it before and well before 3 o'clock if you want us to try to get to your questions today.
You know, Denise, early on when you guys started doing stereotactic biopsies and ultrasound-guided biopsies down in the imaging center, I was very nervous that you might be missing things. And I think I even gave you a call. It's been probably too long to remember, but... And was very reassured that what you were doing back then was following up. I think in the early years, you called back patients at a year later. And I think you still do this, do a post-biopsy screening to make sure that there wasn't something that then developed that you had missed. And your data was so good on that I think we've all become far more comfortable with stereotactic biopsies being representative. And as I understand it, you know, Anchorage has been way out ahead of the curve on that becoming the standard here in our community.
We actually have when we first began doing percutaneous biopsies, our surgical colleagues were very accepting of it. And that's not been true everywhere. It's a less invasive procedure for the patient, less downtime for the patient, and the results are very good. We do still, actually, we follow people up at 6 months post-procedure. The sampling, the potential for sampling error is always there, and we don't want to have that happen. And if it were to happen, we'd want to catch it early. So we see those people back at 6 months post-biopsy and then at 1 year post-biopsy. Mm-hmm.
And what she means by sampling error is mm-hmm. that they took a biopsy, but they were adjacent to but didn't find the cancer right next to it. And they're amazing. You guys are amazingly good at hitting your target. I had a patient once, actually, who you saw some calcifications, got him out. It was a ductal carcinoma in situ, I think. And then when she had the lumpectomy, it was not there anymore.
Right. Right.
That's happened more than once.
It happens with some regularity because, again, we're biopsying sometimes very tiny lesions, and mm-hmm. so they may all come out in the biopsy, which is mm-hmm. – that's not a bad thing for the patient, actually. Yeah. That's a good thing.
Right.
Being female, You said as a risk factor, the primary one, although there are males who develop breast cancer, and you said age. What are other risk factors? And we talked about if you had the BRCA gene, if you had other close family members, women that had ovarian or breast cancer, it perks everybody's attention. What else?
Well, there's a few other basically lifestyle risk factors that probably increase your risk. Obesity essentially, fat tissue essentially creates estrogen, and estrogen increases breast cancer, we think. Alcohol use, not having children early or not breastfeeding. And maybe that's doesn't actually increase a person's risk, but they don't have the chance to reduce their risk. We know that women who start having children before they're 30 and breastfeed them for at least 6 months or more reduce their risk. Perhaps women who exercise also reduce their risk. None of these is set in stone. You can do all of these things and still end up with breast cancer. But when we look at large population data, then we see that these things correlate with lower rates of breast cancer.
Vitamin D.
I love that topic.
Is is everywhere. What's the deal on vitamin D, and what does vitamin D deficiency have to do with possibly increased risk, or does it?
There are the high-quality studies, that is the prospective randomized placebo-controlled studies, are not yet available and may never be done. At this point in time, it's hard to say you ladies take vitamin D and you avoid it. But what we've got are a lot of studies that we gaily went along and took our one-a-day vitamins, which had enough vitamin D to prevent rickets. But as it turns out, we now are looking at vitamin D levels. And as we look retrospectively at people who have low vitamin D levels as compared to high vitamin D levels, we're seeing a lot of differences in those groups. And low vitamin D levels, since there are vitamin D receptors all over our body, not just in our bones, seem to have more diabetes, heart disease, breast cancer, just a whole host of things. And it's alarming, especially up here in Alaska, where I found about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, when I tested vitamin D levels in my patients, most of whom were getting a total of probably 700 or 800 units of vitamin D a day, that about 90% of them still had low levels. I now recommend that if you're an Alaskan, you take at least 1,000 units a day, even if you've got good levels, just to keep your levels up.
It's hard to get enough vitamin D by food alone.
They don't supplement much at all. I mean, there's a little bit of vitamin D added to milk, some orange juice, your multivitamin, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, vitamin D is a big issue. It's an important immune modulator. It's been linked to a lot of cancers, a lot of immune deficiency. Multiple sclerosis seems to have a latitudinal distribution. And I was looking at breast cancer rates by state. Alaska's incidence is in the higher level. And when you look at the United States on a map, Washington, Oregon, Minnesota, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, October, Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma are the highest, not all of them at the highest. And then Idaho is kind of it stands out. It's got a lower level. It's up north. But there seems to be a distribution across northern. So that's what's gotten people's attention. Mm-hmm. Then they started looking at vitamin D levels. And vitamin D is primarily obtained from the sun and allergy work. I've talked about this. And once you get north of almost, believe it or not, someplace like Oregon or at Georgia, from November through February or March, the sun is not at the proper inclination to really produce enough vitamin D in your skin. And so when it gets low enough, the radiation that's important actually ricochets off the atmosphere. So once you get up to Alaska, your levels are pretty doggone low. Mine was 43 when it was tested, and I've been up here since 1978, however. So I don't know about this. I don't know what to say. I mean, a lot of circumstantial evidence mm-hmm. is very interesting, and that's just what's bringing it up as a risk factor.
And I think Tina's right. We may never see those true prospective trials to get that really solid data that would help us, make that decision.
Actually, in the field of pediatrics and stuff, I've been fascinated recently by a thread of data that suggests that vitamin D deficiency may also be implicated in autism when mothers are low on vitamin D. Right, I know. I'm starting to reach here. The phones are going to start to ring here.
No. It's important to keep an open mind about it. We've been battling autism and vaccines so long. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, call 550-8422. Our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. After this break, we'll continue to take some calls and talk with Dr. Denise Farley and Dr. Tina Thompson on Line 1. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's guests are Drs. Tina Thompson and Denise Farley, and we're talking about breast cancer. You can email your questions or comments to us at line1@aprn.org, or you can give us a call between now and a little before 3 o'clock at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And remember, if you're listening to Line 1 at 8 o'clock or later, it's recorded a program, and there will not be a chance to answer your questions. Here's an email from a listener. It's a woman who says she's had a double mastectomy. She had a DIP. You guys will have to define that for me, which is some kind of abdominal tissue reconstructed into her breast. What are the screening options now that she doesn't have breast tissue? First off, does she still have risk of breast cancer, and how would screening be done, and what would be recommended?
The risk of breast cancer is almost gone if you have, in fact, had a bilateral mastectomy, but it's not completely gone. The incidence in women who have had a completed mastectomy on both sides is extremely low. We really don't have great imaging tools for these people. They've had a reconstruction of some sort, and it sounds like she's had a reconstruction using her own tissue, not implants. But really, those women are best served not by an imaging procedure, but by careful clinical exam. And if in fact something develops on the physical exam, then they can come to us for imaging. But we don't normally screen them.
And in a patient who's had a complete mastectomy, any recurrences may not be local. They may be distant, you know, a metastasis or something like that. So it's not so much breast exam or mammograms or anything like that that are important for watching.
Routinely, the follow-up for this a lady like hers would be what? How often would she be seeing somebody? What would be typical ways you're monitoring for recurrence or metastases?
Well, an oncologist might have something to say about that, but it would probably their opinion would probably be informed by her stage of disease at the time. But presuming she had early stage and a cure, then routine exams like with her primary care practitioner would probably be sufficient unless she found something. That's always important.
So it's certainly important just to continue monitoring, even though it looks like everything is okay.
Keep it in mind.
Rick, you're on Line 1. What can we do for you?
Oh, hello. I just wanted to mention that there is a significant problem with arsenic in well water in Alaska. And when we had ours tested, I talked with the lab technician, and he told me that he's found it as high as 130, I think he said, in Cooper Landing, and 160 in Palmer, and the standard is 10 parts per billion. And this can cause a whole host of cancers, and I think it's probably not addressed as often as it should be.
Mm-hmm. Do we know, I'm looking at my guest, you guys know anything about the association between arsenic and or heavy metals in cancer, breast cancer in particular?
I'm not familiar with any literature about it.
Yeah. All right. Rick, thanks for bringing it up. I don't know if we can take it any further. I think it's a good point.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for your call. All right. Ben, you're on line one. Let's go ahead and take your call as well.
Yeah, I just had a question about, I read a recent report that Alaska Native women have a higher rate of breast cancer from 1970, starting from 73 to 2008 or something like that, over the last 30 years. And I was wondering if 1973, that date stuck out to me. I was wondering if there's any correlation between breast cancer and abortion, if a woman has an abortion, if she has a higher chance of having breast cancer, if there's been any studies like that at all.
Actually, the topic of abortion and breast cancer is kind of interesting, and it has to do with the number of completed pregnancies and the opportunity to breastfeed. So if you take a woman who has an abortion and you compare her to the women who have that child and breastfeed it, then the woman who's had the abortion has a higher rate of breast cancer. If, on the other hand, you take a woman who's had the abortion and compare her to a woman who hasn't had a child and hasn't breastfed, then the rate of breast cancer is not increased.
Oh, okay. There's no increase at all just from the abortion itself.
So it's almost like, you tell me if I'm reading this wrong, but it's almost like breastfeeding is protective.
Correct.
The issue.
Right.
At least that's what the epidemiologic studies would suggest.
The woman who has the abortion doesn't have the opportunity to reduce her risk.
Right.
Just the same way as the woman who did not have the child.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It is an interesting comment, though, that the increased detection of breast cancer in Native women has been striking. Mm. It was thought historically that they had a very low incidence of breast cancer. And initially, when we started seeing that rise occur, we were thinking that we were just detecting more, and it doesn't seem to be the case. It seems that the increase in breast cancer in Native women does seem to be real. I think it has begun to level off, sort of like we've seen in other populations of women. But it was a real change over that 20, 30-year period.
Thank you. The question I had just, it was sparked after seeing a study. I think it was Anchorage Daily News said that the study was from 1973 forwards when they started seeing it. And I just, in my mind, I was like, oh, 73, I thought that's when Roe v. Wade was decided or something. And I didn't know if that was a correlation or not.
Yeah, I wonder if that's when they started collecting data. I don't remember when data started collecting, but it was about that time.
It was about that time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You've got to be very careful making associations versus causality. I'm going to use my classic example. I'm talking to patients. Just because we wear shoes as kids doesn't mean that our feet are getting bigger because we're wearing shoes. So,
you know, a great...
No, wait a minute. Are you going to argue with... No.
Okay. No. Wait a darn minute. Right?
The point is association and causality are completely different, and it's very common for human beings to make the assumption that something that happens close in time to something is causal, and that's not true. And that's the point. So we got to be very, very careful about that. Now, Tina, go ahead.
A great one on that topic with respect to breast cancer is if you look at the incidence of breast cancer in different countries, Japanese women have a very low incidence. It's been rising, but it's still dramatically lower than U.S., European, other countries. An association that was made 10, 15 years ago was that Japanese women eat more soy products, therefore soy must be the problem, and we should eat more soy products and we'll get less breast cancer. Well, we've kind of come 180 degrees because now we correlate soy with an estrogen-like effect. And in fact, any woman who has breast cancer, her oncologist and her breast surgeon even will tell her to eat less soy. It has an estrogen-like effect, and that may be counterproductive. So we've come full circle.
Yeah, and that kind of logic, that kind of research is constantly confusing to the public, I think. I think there's we over-exaggerate and overreact to some of the reports that we see, and it's very difficult to prove causal relationships, and yet it's relatively easy to make associations, and we all kind of get sucked in. Medicine is not immune to having done that, and the point I want to make is you constantly got to keep doing the test. You kind of keep asking the questions. Does that make a difference? And that's why you see one day vitamin D looks like a bad guy, and the next day it's, well, you know, this is maybe pretty good, you know. So you got to keep an open mind. You got to look at the studies. You got to look at what's done, how many patients were done, where there's some biases. And so I just, that's my constant plug to keep thinking about what's going on out there. What are some of the inaccuracy? What makes mammograms harder to do or more inaccurate? What are the factors that relate to that, Denise?
Lots of things. Typically, not always the case, but typically women who are younger have more dense breast parenchyma. The tissue in the breast is harder to penetrate on the mammogram and harder to look through to look for the cancer. Although I do have women who are in their 80s and 90s who also have very dense breast tissue. The breast that is more fatty tends to be much easier for us to evaluate. So there are those kinds of factors that we can't really impact and we have to just deal with. The quality of the mammogram is critical. You really want to have a high-quality study that's going to give you the best chance at seeing through the tissue. Unfortunately, we do need to compress the breast because that's how we make it thin enough so that we can see through it. So that's the least favorite part of the mammogram. You need to read the mammogram in ideal circumstances. It's best for us to interpret that study when we're in a quiet room and nobody's bothering us and the phone's not ringing, because you actually do have to concentrate. You made a really good point that it is critical that we look at these carefully. And in fact, in the screening environment, if anything, we're looking at those images closer, or we should be looking at them closer than in a diagnostic environment where I already know there's something wrong, and so my antenna are, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. alert, and I'm looking very carefully. In the screening environment, it would be easy to be lulled into, you know, being a little bit complacent, and you want not to do that.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it true that you, in a woman who's menstruating, that you'll get a better mammogram if we can get her just at the end of her menstrual cycle? When the swelling and that kind of stuff in the breast goes away?
That's exactly true. It can make a difference in breast density, and it also makes a big difference in how tender the breast is. Mm-hmm. So typically, if they come in at the right phase of their cycle, we're able to get better compression and not make it quite so uncomfortable.
Well, what about digital? You guys went digital a few years ago.
We did. The transition was difficult. I never want to live through another year like that. But digital mammography has the advantage that it allows us to see better through dense tissue. If you have a woman who has completely fatty replaced breasts, there's really not much difference between film screen mammography and digital mammography. But if it's a younger woman or a woman with very dense tissue, a premenopausal woman, then digital mammography gives us an edge. We can see better through that dense tissue.
So I sometimes tell my patients that what you guys are doing down there is you're photoshopping. The digital gives you the chance to photoshop their mammogram films. Is that about right?
It does. I can actually manipulate the images. A film screen image, if you think about it, it's like your still picture that you take with your film camera. Except I don't have a darkroom where I can go and manipulate it. It's what you see is what you get. With the digital image, that's not really true. We can manipulate that image and see better.
And, you know, the year you guys went digital, when I went in for my mammogram, that was the year I got called back for an extra view. And I figured it was because they could finally see something that had been there. And it proved to be nothing. But did you have a whole bunch of women that you had to then rescreen that year? Was that the...
We did. The callback rate, the first year that a facility switches from film screen to digital, will almost inevitably go up because you are seeing things you've never seen before. But what happens after that first year, the callback rate actually goes down, where we have to call somebody back for more views.
Compared to before,
because now we can manipulate the image. Mm-hmm. And I also have a digital image to compare to. It's apples to apples. But we actually don't call as many people back as we used to, mm-hmm. which is nice for patients. That's anxiety producing. To have to come back and see me again and get extra views, that's not nice. That's not a good thing to have to do.
And the digital switch is what also made it possible for you to have the other locations so that you can sit in your dark room here on the campus and look at films that have been done elsewhere?
I can. If they're in our system, then I can review images from Providence Imaging Center, which is where I'm sitting, and also from the two offices, one in the Valley and one in South Anchorage, and they're all available to me right there, which is, mm-hmm. that's a nice thing too.
Okay, another variable. What about the difference between who's reading the images? How important is that? And Are computers going to make radiologists looking at mammograms obsolete? The reason I ask the question, if you can Photoshop it, then a computer can do it better than you can Photoshop it. And computers are being found to be very useful in those kinds of things. I don't know the answer to this question. It just popped into my head. So those are, I know the answer, I think, to the who's reading them answer. But
I'll take the second one first. we actually do have computer-aided detection for mammography. Uh-huh. And so there's an algorithm in my computer that when I pull up the woman's images, I have the ability to toggle the computer on and off. And the computer will tell me the things that it thought were interesting. Hmm. They have gotten better. Hmm. Initially, when they first developed these programs, every image on every mammogram had like 12 marks on it. Well, that's not particularly useful. Mm-hmm. But they've gotten smarter over time, and so now we can use those systems to help us. I still have to disregard many of the marks because they're not important. So the computer is not quite as sophisticated as we'd like it to be, but it's better than it used to be. Mm-hmm. I think it is important that people who do breast imaging do it on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. I think that there's good data that shows that people who read more mammograms in general do better at reading mammograms. There are some minimal requirements actually now in the country. You can't read mammograms unless you do a certain number of them in a period of time. You're not allowed to read them anymore. And that's the only imaging procedure that's like that, actually.
Is there a limit to how many you're allowed to read? You know, because there was a whole buzz of 15 years ago or something about cytotechnologists reading too many pap smears.
No, there's no maximum.
Elise, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Well, as you're discussing this, I have a health plan that will not cover me for an annual breast exam, though it will pay for a mammography, because I've had a hysterectomy and don't have a uterus. And I'm wondering, is there any logic to that? Is there like a study that says if your uterus is out, you're not as apt to get breast cancer, so you don't need that exam?
Well, if you could only get a breast exam or a mammogram, and, you know, we think that the combination is best, but if you could only get one or the other, I'd vote for the mammogram. You've got a suboptimal plan there, if you ask me.
I agree with Dr. Thompson. It's clear that it's a combo thing. You need to have both. And I don't think that there's certainly nothing that says if your uterus has been removed that you're at decreased risk for breast cancer.
Well, for what it's worth, this is what the state of Alaska offers to its retirees.
Thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, this brings up a huge number of issues, and all I can say is we can do better in this country. We need to keep thinking about it. I don't know the right answer. It's obviously difficult, but we need to do better. So, another question. What about costs? What about people who can't afford, for one reason or the other, to get mammography? What are the options and so forth?
There are some good options out there, actually. There are programs that are funded for breast and cervical screening, and there's a program called the BCHC, Breast and Cervical Health Check. That does provide screening for breast and cervical cancer. Those women get a physical exam, and they also get a mammogram and a pap smear. There are income qualifications for it, so you can't, you know, be making bazillions of dollars and qualify for this program. But there are somewhat generous guidelines, and I would suggest that women who aren't covered by their health insurance or who have no health insurance to consider calling them. And I've got their phone number. It's 1-800-410-6266. It's available here in Alaska. There are providers around the state, actually, that will see these patients. So, again, it's 1-800-410-6266.
All right, and let me remind our listeners also, you got about a little less than 10 minutes if you've got questions or comments. Outside phone number is 1-800-478-8255. You can email us at lineone, lineone, at aprn.org, and our local number 550-8422. Tina, when we communicated by email before the program, you had sent me some questions, and you mentioned that prevention is better than early diagnosis, and I think that's one of the few things most people can agree on without too much argument. Tell us what you mean.
Every now and then I'll see a patient who hasn't come in for a few years, and we don't like to see that. We'd like to see people get their annual pap smear or mammogram or whatever, but I'll sometimes jokingly tell her that if she's been living right, then I'll forgive her. because, you know, as we talked about some of these lifestyle things that play a role with breast cancer, it also does with cervical cancer. And Thad, when you spoke earlier about flu vaccines and stuff like that, that's in the realm of prevention. With cervical disorders, with the HPV vaccine, we now have a vaccine for young women that'll probably make a big difference in cervical disease later. We don't yet have a vaccine against breast cancer. Wouldn't that be lovely? But when we do, then we'll be able to step things back to prevention rather than the early diagnosis we've been talking about here.
You know, what we haven't mentioned and needs to be commented on is the breast self-exam. Where are we with the breast self-exam? Why haven't we talked about it yet?
Well, there's a thing out there called the Cochrane database. And what the Cochrane people do is it's a bunch of smart folks that take a look at the world's medical literature, and they opine on different topics. And a few years ago, the Cochrane database came out and said that the breast self-exam was not particularly useful. In fact, it might even be counterproductive. Basically, if you take a group of women that go cruising monthly for breast lumps as compared to their identical twin sisters who don't, the women who do monthly breast self-exams will find a lot of stuff, but it's not clear that it makes a difference in disease and death rates, which is what we want for a good screening test. We love, you know, that Denise is doing a great job at the imaging center with finding breast cancers and that kind of stuff, but we don't want her to do a lot of extra mammograms, ultrasounds, biopsies, and all kinds of stuff. So I sometimes tell patients that they've been absolved of the requirement to do a breast self-exam monthly. We do want them to report things that they run into, just like you'd report a abnormal-looking mole or anything else. But going on a cruise every month is they've been absolved of that responsibility.
Another very not unreasonable jump in conclusion when we start thinking about medicine or thinking about anything is we sometimes make an irrational jump ahead and forget to put things in perspective. And this gets to an article that I was reading just before we came in, and I was surprised to learn that the natural history of in situ cancers, it may not be all that bad. So the logical conclusion, or what we would all think, is finding a cancer is bad, but it may not be. It may not be the end all, and so all of our efforts are designed on the idea, well, that's bad, but at least we know now with prostate cancer, we need to really stop and think about the age and a lot of situations. What do y'all want to say about that as far as it relates to breast cancer?
I think that's really true. I think the natural history of in situ breast cancer may be that it will progress to an invasive cancer, or it may not. I'm not sure I'm convinced that they ever totally go away, but they very well might not progress to an invasive cancer in the patient's lifetime.
For some reason or another, the body may take care of this problem.
Right,
without us.
Or it's a particularly indolent cancer, and breast cancer in general is a relatively slow-growing tumor. Unfortunately, at this point in time, we don't have a really good way to know which in situ cancers are going to become invasive and potentially killer cancers, and which ones are just going to sit there. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of stuck with treating all of them. There's a lot of discussion, and I hear it, you know, in breast cancer conference all the time about, not being too aggressive with some treatments and trying to tailor the treatment to the patient and the disease. So I think it's an interesting question. The same thing is true, of course, for invasive cancers. There is good data, particularly out of Sweden, that looks at that deliberately ignored how aggressive the cancer looked and only looked at the size at the time of diagnosis. And there was a substantial difference. Any cancer that was diagnosed at less than a centimeter, now that's really small and those are hard to pick up, did better than if they were bigger than that, regardless of how aggressive the tumor looked. So that's sort of compelling data, and it does argue that screening, if we can find those early cancers, should work for reducing mortality.
You know, that article you sent was just amazing. What they did was they went through all these different countries with large databases and looked at, and they estimated that as many as a third to a half of the cancers might not have actually proven to be clinically significant that they were finding.
And how they define clinically significant is important. Because that's what the question is, well, what the heck do you mean right. by clinically insignificant?
Yeah, they weren't going to kill the person or cause them disease.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I found interesting about that article was that most other countries stopped screening at about 70. Mm-hmm. Just a couple countries. Sweden was the only other one that goes up to 75. We actually don't even talk about when to stop screening in America.
I mean, there's not only data. We don't maybe have enough information to make those kinds of decisions. And then there's the ethical issues, and then you get into this debate, are you rationing health care? I mean, it's a huge issue. We've really got only 1 minute left. I want to we have someone who's called in and wants to talk about prophylactic treatment for high risk, and I just apologize. I don't think that's a topic I can get to in the next minute, so I apologize for not getting on. What do we want to leave our guests, our listeners, remembering most importantly at the end of the program?
I think we need to remember or ask them to remember that breast cancer is important. It's quite important in this country for women. And that we do have good screening tools, and those screening tools properly used can make a difference in morbidity and mortality, in other words, in long-term survival.
I guess the thing that I'd like to say is that what we're doing here is we're trying to help more people live well long and not to lose focus on the idea of living well.
Okay. I also want to remind our listeners who may not have called or didn't get a chance to take care of them that they can very easily just go to our website. I do make an effort every week to put some very reliable websites, and a little effort there may get you to some more reliable information about the problem at hand. So thanks, Dr. Farley and Dr. Thompson. It's been a wonderful hour again. Appreciate your time. Line One returns next week with my guests. Then will be Karen Moyer, co-founder of the Moyer Foundation, and Donna Stevens, who's executive director of Hospice of Anchorage. Our topic will be helping children deal with the death of a relative or close friend, how to help children grieve. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Karen Spack is engineer in today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.